It's sure good to see all your faces. It's so nice to be here. When Connie assigned me this chapter in the book, The Essential Earnest Homes, she gave me a lot of leeway to expand and use other materials. So I've done that. And when I thought of the chapter, it's the meeting place of science and religion. My first thoughts were my garden and Star Wars. I know. There's an old Chinese saying that if you want to be happy for a little while, get drunk. If you want to be happy longer, fall in love. If you want to be happy forever, take up gardening. So my garden is both spiritual and it's also a science project. Many, many science projects going on all the time. And it's a place that's so dear to my heart. And I love being outdoors, and I love, you know, the birds and the wind, and just everything about gardening just delights me so much. And so that's my really special place. Now I was reading that it's things dying and being reborn, new things sprouting up, renewal, transformation, balance, order, and harmony. Well, I can say I have most of that, but I would say order often is, you know, things kind of, the weeds get out of whack, you know, and I'm always changing this and changing that. So order sometimes, but not always. And I wanted to share with you a book that's called Magic and Medicine of Plants. In the beginning, the author, I'm not sure who the author is, it's a Reader's Digest book, so it's probably many, many authors. It says that nearly half of all medicines currently prescribed are derived from members of the plant kingdom. Glycosides, alkaloids, essential oils, tannins, and flavonoids. So we know that not only are we getting our vegetables and enjoyment of our flowers, they're also serving us in so many ways in healing. And I wanted to show you this. One chapter is called Nature's Chemical Industry, and it shows a picture of all, it tells all the different things that come from the garden. And one of the big things that plants do has to do with photosynthesis. And the book says, within plant cells, a great many interconnected chemical reactions proceed silently and persistently. The most important reaction is photosynthesis, carrying on mainly by the green leaves of plants. This process is fundamental to life on Earth, for it provides both our world's food and the oxygen which we need to breathe. So this is a wonderful book with all kinds of information about plants and healing and gardening. So I really enjoy that one. Not only do I enjoy my garden, but my cats love it too. I have two cats, one black, one white. Well, the white one isn't white right now. He won't be white until the end of summer, because he loves to go out in the garden and he rolls in the dirt. So this pure white cat, by the time he comes in the house every day, he's got clay color and he's got dirt color and mulch color, you know. But he is so happy, and he spends almost, you know, other than his sleepy time in the daytime, he's outdoors. My other cat is the little black cat, and he's very dignified. I call him my little gentleman. He doesn't roll in the dirt. He doesn't come in dirty, and he's always clean and proper. Where the other one is like, a big sloppy kid, you know. He's, and if anybody gets in trouble, it's the white one. You know, if somebody's knocking stuff over or getting into something they're not supposed to, it's always him. And the other one, it just never happens. But they love the garden. I also wanted to mention that three people currently live with me, and different ages, a little bit older, two grandkids. One of them is temporary, and she's recovering from extreme immaturity. She was supposed to be there 2 months, and now it's going on five, and we're trying to, you know, get her out the door and on her own. Anyway, sometimes it's very challenging. Excuse me. So when it gets to be overwhelming, and I won't say who does what or when, but when it all overwhelms me, then where do I head? My haven, out in the yard. And I go out and I have this I have this bench that is really special to me. It doesn't look like much, but years ago when we used to live in Reston, my grandson Jason and my daughter Sue found this bench that somebody obviously was throwing it away. They had set it on the roadside, and they walked, each of them took an end of this bench, and they walked it 3 miles to my house. Wow. And I've had it now for like 20 years. Oh, wow. And so it's one of those that swings back and forth. So when I get overwhelmed and teed off and frustrated, I go out and I sit on my bench and swing and just listen to the birds and watch them, you know, on the bird feeders, and watch things growing. And I really, it gives me a total sense of peace and stillness, and just a sense of you know, the wonders of life. And it's healing. By the time I get up off that bench, everything's fine. So this is why I love the whole gardening thing. And on a lighter vein, we'll talk about manure. I've read this in a book somewhere, and it says, among the deeper mysteries of life is the mystery of manure. How awful it smells and looks, how repulsive it feels, yet how delicious it is to our vegetables and flowers. They take it in, and through the life powers within them, absorb its very substance into their beings and transform that smelly stuff into delicious food and glorious flowers. I like how they express that. But personally, my own favorite organic fertilizer is from a company called Neptune's Garden. And it's a wonderful sludge made of fish guts and seaweed.
Oh.
Much nicer than manure. Yuck. But my plants love it, and I've been using that for years. And this reminds me how we nourish our own inner state of being through our meditations and affirmations and our interchanging with nature and our visits to study group. when I moved to my house 19 years ago, I moved in December, and it's 3 acres, and there were trees on the property, but I didn't see any signs at all of flowers of any kind. And so I was looking forward to spring to see if anything came up in the yard. Well, as spring started coming on, I started seeing these little red fingers sticking up in the grass. They weren't in a flower bed or anything. They were just in the grass, and I thought they were a weed, but then I noticed that they were all in a line. So I figured, you know, if they're all in a row, they must be something that was planted. So I didn't do anything with them, didn't mow them down, and so they kept getting bigger and bigger, and pretty soon these bushes came up. They were peonies. It's a whole row of peonies. That's where your peony came from. Yeah, they came from these guys. They've been there. They were there when I came. Had no idea what they were, and they weren't even in a bed, just in the grass. So I made them a flower bed, and now they're encircled with a row of daylilies. And every year they're just these magnificent blooms, and with a scent, and I bring them in the house, and you know, it's just wonderful. It was so interesting, you know, to see this little finger, and they were red, but you know, as the stems come up, they're not red. They change. I also have a hosta that's sort of like that. It's a variegated hosta, and when it comes up out of the ground, it's only like a couple of inches high. It's purple. These little, and it looks like little, kind of little nubby things, and they're purple. But then as it grows up, it's a green and yellow hosta. It's probably about like this. So it's interesting how they have these different colors and they change. Oh, and also, I wanted to share with you, I also have an inside garden, and that is, I started growing succulents a year or so ago, and then for years I've been growing African violets. My house is overcome now with plants, and I also have a commercial greenhouse, and I have a lot of stuff out there, but African violets can't live in it, so they're always in the house. The succulents, I'm just now moving out to the greenhouse, because a lot of them can't take the cold nights. But it's been amazing to me to learn all these things about succulents. They're a whole different field. Even though I have the outdoor succulents, I have like the autumn joy sedums that, you know, they're about, you know, 2.5-3 feet high. Mm-hmm. I have two or three different kinds of ground cover sedums. But the indoor ones are a whole different story. Whole new learning experience. And I wanted to share with you one of the things that I have found so fascinating is that on almost all of the succulents, you can take a leaf. And you know how many leaves a plant can have. Each leaf, you just let it dry out a little bit so the end kind of seals, and then it can be planted. And each leaf can produce up to 6 new plants per leaf. And that's as many as I've had. This particular one, here's a leaf off of one, and it has 4 new plants.
Wow.
So. Wow. Huh. And I just find that so fascinating. So I probably have like 200 leaves with plants.
Oh, thank you.
Anyway, there's so many interesting things about different kinds of gardening. I just wanted to share with you that I just find things like that amazing. Because if you think about one plant that maybe has, you know, 50, 100 leaves, and they can produce that many plants. Just, wow. And before I get off the subject of gardening, I'm really excited this year because I'm doing a lot of new planting. And so far, I've put in 2 pink crepe myrtle trees. Oh, I meant to mention that I don't, some of you might remember that last May, we had a tornado came through, and my hickory tree fell over, smashed my car. Well, the whole bed where the hickory tree was a shade bed all around it. So all of those plants had to be moved and replanted, and then there's been this big bare spot for a year. So now I have 2 crepe myrtles in there. I have encore azaleas, and encores are the ones that bloom 3 times a year. Wow. And not once. They'll be the ones in the purple cans if you ever buy an azaleas. So I put in those. I put in a radiant crab apple, a pink cherry blossom tree, not all in the same spot, but around the yard, a beach plum, and then I have about 9 green giant arborvitaes that I'm putting around the front of the properties around the road so that we have more privacy up there. Okay. And then my granddaughter is working at Merrifield Gardens, and she brings home plants all the time that they're getting ready to toss out. Perfectly good plants, but they get these trucks and trucks and truckloads coming in. They have to move everything out that's been there. So She's been bringing home pansies, and she brought home a huge container that has about, I don't know, maybe 40 or 50 new vegetables and things like cantaloupe and
Wow.
watermelon, all
Wow.
ready to plant. So
Wow.
this is my planting year. And I
Yeah.
haven't planted seed one. This time last year, I had two tables in my house covered with little seedlings ready to go out in the garden. And this year I haven't done one. I don't need
Yeah,
to.
that's awesome. Yeah,
So
inspired.
that was fun. Okay, back to our chapter. This is the chapter, The Meeting Place of Science and Religion. And it starts with Ernest Holmes' statement that the science of mind is a science because the results of prayer can be proven. And then he suggests we also take a lesson from the natural world and uses the hand of his example. So here we are back to nature again. And so what he talked about is that the hen sets on her nest for 21 days before the chicks are hatched. Does everyone know about what setting is? But I noticed in the story he never mentions the rooster's part in it all. He just talks about the hen setting on the nest. And he says that hens don't live by calendars and they don't know the difference between Mondays or Fridays, but they have this intuitive sense of knowing what to do and how long to do it. So they set for the 21 days. And this was something that I didn't know. He said that every day they only leave the nest long enough to keep this so the eggs stay warm, and they turn the eggs every day so that the chicks are normal. And I didn't know that part of it, that they turn the eggs. So that was new information. And he said the hen never doubts, never questions, never argues, apparently does no complaining. There she sets, and the eggs will hatch because the hen has followed the law of her instinct. No one ever heard of a hen cackling about her sins or squawking to high heaven to save her soul. It appears she never had a guilt complex. She has never studied how to become spiritual. She keeps one idea warm for 21 days without ever doubting, keeping their eggs warm and keeping the concept alive, awake, and aware. And Ernest Holmes says, well, we don't wish to become hens. We act more like geese. We can deny our own good, even though it is always there to be accepted. We argue whether we're good enough and are we spiritually enlightened. We better get up and shake off the dust and get back to those eggs. After all, the hen is wise. I have a chicken story of my own. My neighbors just up the road, new neighbors, and they have a chicken coop on. They all work, and every day when they come home, they let the chickens out so they can free range. Well, we live on a gravel road, and often the chickens are free ranging on the gravel road. So the other day, my grandson and I were in my truck driving up the hill, and here's this chicken right in the middle of the road. And so we slowed down and thought the chicken, wouldn't move away. And she just stood there looking at this truck. Here's this great big bright red truck coming at her. She never moved a muscle. And we got closer and closer. Jason honked the horn. The chicken didn't move. She just faced us off. She was not going to move out of that road. He was driving, and we ended up, he had to drive over into the grass all the way around to avoid hitting this chicken. She was still standing there after we passed by. She held her ground. So all I have to say is, I don't think the chicken was wise, but I think she was really brave. Okay, remember I mentioned Star Wars. Okay, on to Star Wars. How many of you remember the first time you saw Star Wars, the original?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, for me it was amazing experience, amazing. Star Wars first screened on May 25th, 1977. I was 38 years old. I was a third-year graduate, and I was a longtime member of the WKC church. That's what my teenage youth group called our church, was Weird Kooky Church, the WKC, otherwise known to be as West Valley Church of Religious Science in Canoga Park, California. So that's where I was at. And in Star Wars, Obi-Wan Kenobi tells Luke Skywalker that the Force is an energy field in the universe created by all living things and binds us all together. It surrounds us and penetrates us. And he tells Luke to always trust in the Force and says that anyone can use its power. So I wanted to read what Ernest Holmes has to say. Let me find the right place. I may not have the right book with me. I'm not sure how many books I have. Nope. I think I have another place where it says it. Bear with me just a moment. Ernest Holmes says, science of mind is based on the theory that there's a universal mind and an eternal spirit from which all things spring. The spirit is the creator and the sustainer of all that is. You have immediate access to this divine mind, this universal principle, this creative power. Man has access to the great whole and draws as much power from this source as he is capable of intelligently using. Man is not the power, he is the avenue through which the power flows. This is the power talked about in Star Wars and is the same power that flows through us all. Mm-hmm. I knew there was a reason I put that in here twice.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I've evidently left the other book at home. Anyway, I was deeply moved when I saw this movie. And when I heard this expression about the Force, it was like, yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And it was... Because at that time, I didn't know anybody outside of our church circle that talked about universal intelligence or universal mind. I mean, it seemed like most of the people I knew were Christians and were talking a different language than we were talking. And I thought, with this movie and its great appeal, it's going to give a whole lot of people a whole different perspective on our whole philosophy of divine intelligence. And so when I was preparing for this talk, I got to thinking about George Lucas that wrote and directed Star Wars. I got to thinking about where was he coming from and how did he come up with this concept for Star Wars. So I found one of his biographies, and this one is by Terry Mattingly, and it's called George Lucas, The Force and God. And it starts out, a long time ago in a movie multiplex not so far away, a child looked up and asked, Mom, Dad, is the Force the same thing as God? Children have been asking that question for over 20 years, and the simple answer is yes. Lucas was well aware that his work invaded turf traditionally reserved for parents, priests, and ministers. And he wrote Star Wars shortly after the Cultural Revolution of the 60s, and he sensed a spiritual void. He said, I wanted it to be a traditional moral study, to have some sort of precepts in that children could understand. There was always a lesson to be learned. Traditionally, we get that from church, family, and art. And in the modern world, we get these lessons from the media and from movies. Lucas set out to create a modern mythology to teach right and wrong. The result was a fusion of Flash Gordon Conquers the Universe, King Arthur Legends, The Terminator, and Japanese samurai stories. The impact of Lucas' work has led some researchers to speak in terms of a Star Wars generation. A modern preacher who wants to discuss self-sacrifice will be understood by more people if he refers to the death of Jedi Knight Obi-Wan Kenobi rather than that of a biblical saint. It was natural that my generation would latch onto these stories, said the webmaster of the unofficial Star Wars homepage, one of nearly 1,000 Star Wars internet sites. They were much more attractive and appropriate than the ancient myths of Judeo-Christian theology. How could these old stories possibly compete with the majesty and scope of the Star Wars universe? Lucas grew up in 1950 in the 1950s in Modesto, California, reading comics, escaping to movies, and watching TV. He attended a Methodist church with his family and was turned off by Sunday school. He also visited the housekeeper's German Lutheran congregation, where he's impressed by the elaborate rituals. And traces of these experiences are woven into his work. The message of Star Wars is religious. God isn't dead, he's there if you want him to be. Lucas put it this way, the laws really are in yourself. And Jedi Master Yoga clearly teaches a form of Buddhism, yet the Lucas liturgy also proclaims the Force may be with you, and which is a variation on the Christian phrase, may the Lord be with you. And the plot includes other symbols and themes from biblical faith. Lucas has embraced both passive Oriental philosophies and the Christian ethic of responsibility and self-sacrifice. And I thought this was interesting. This is in his autobiography. Lucas acknowledges that by setting his goals so high, he is asking to be judged by very high standards. The creator of Star Wars explains that one of his least favorite fantasies is about what will happen when he dies. Perhaps, he said, he will come face to face with God and hear these words. You've had your chance and you blew it. Get out! Sounds like the Terminator. And I love watching the TV series Through the Wormhole with Morgan Freeman. And the first episode of the eighth and the final chapter is entitled, Is the Force With Us? And it begins with the universe is constantly communicating with itself everywhere. And it says, new research is beginning to reveal a hidden source in the universe, one that penetrates space with trillions of invisible connections, instantly linking every place in our world and joining our future with our past. And Freeman asks this question, is the Force with us? Freeman interviews various scientists who discuss their research projects on topics relating to how our universe started and how we've all evolved. And then back to the essential Ernest Holmes, I found this. An astronomer, Gustav Strandberg, said that when the physical world of space, time, and energy was yet unborn, something far more important existed. This was mind, cosmic mind or world soul, which was and is the source of all things physical, as well as the ultimate origin of our minds. Then I moved on to Einstein briefly. Einstein's theory of gravitational waves, which are ripples in the fabric of the universe, is still being proven, connects everything in the universe. And I wanted to read to you some of Einstein's quotes that I found really interesting. This is Einstein on religion. He says, science without religion is lame. Religion without science is blind. Mm-hmm. He says, human beings, vegetables, or cosmic dust, we all dance to a mysterious tune intoned in the distance by an invisible player. Wow. On the humorous side of things, Einstein said, the hardest thing in the world to understand is the income tax. And he said, only two things are infinite, the universe and human stupidity, and I'm not sure about the former. Once you can accept the universe as matter expanding into nothing that is something, wearing stripes with plaid comes easy. The most aggravating thing about the younger generation is I'm no longer in it. And finally, when his wife asked him to change clothes to meet the German ambassador, he said, they want to see me? Here I am. If they want to see my clothes, open my closet and show them my suits. And lastly, I wanted to share a book that's new to me. How many of you read The Power of Eight by Lynn McTaggart? She was new to me, and I found this while I was researching on this subject here. And she is an expert on the science of spirituality. And it says that her work examines whether a small group of strangers joined together to focus on one intention in meditation and prayer can be the cause of spontaneous healing for individuals within the group. She has witnessed firsthand the impact of group intention and meditation. She has recorded measurable, scientifically observable outcomes. Well, that really appealed to me to read more about what she has done. And in the inner cover of the book, it says, but the greatest discovery of McTaggart's experiments is that group intention has a reciprocal mirror effect, not only transforming the recipient, but also reflecting back on the senders. I'll just read you a couple of things that I thought were interesting in here. She talked about her research. She said, my research soon led me into strange new territory, a revolution in science that challenges many of the most cherished beliefs we hold about our universe and how it operates. The frontier scientists I met during the course of my research, all with impeccable credentials attached to prestigious institutions, had made astonishing discoveries about the subatomic world that seemed to overthrow the current laws of biochemistry and physics. They'd found evidence that all of reality may be connected through the zero-point field, an underlying quantum energy field and vast network of energy exchange. A few frontier biologists had conducted research suggesting that the primary system of communication in the body is not chemical reaction, but quantum frequency and subatomic energy charge. And they say that human consciousness is able to access information beyond the conventional bounds of time and space. Of course, we've been figuring that out too. And also says that thoughts are an actual something with a capacity to change physical matter. So I haven't read all of the book, but just what I gather is what she started off doing was small experiments with groups of people, choosing an intention and everyone focusing at the same time on each day on that person and what that intention was about, and then the results from what this experiment produced. And she, I guess for a period of time, she was doing these groups and she would see all these things happening with people, but she kind of discounted it like, well, you know, it's you know, she didn't believe that it was really like a miracle things happening. And eventually, she has a website, and she decided to try this with really large groups of people. All of her followers, which are really thousands and thousands of people across the world, and she had people working on an intention. All of these people focused on one person with one intention at the same time every day, and evidently the results were miraculous, that all kinds of conditions were healed, relations healed, physical things were healed, and finally it was hitting her, this is really working. And then she decided to hone it down and do groups of 8 people. And so this book is all about how she went through all of these different processes coming to this. And in the back of the book, she actually tells the steps that she has people take. And it's very much like, you know, our 5 steps of treatment. Uh-huh. And I just thought this was a really, really interesting, and it applies everything that you know, that we believe and that we work with. And she doesn't actually put a religious tone to it. And so more and more people are involved in it. So that is my contribution for her book. I'm going to finish reading it and maybe have more to tell you about it later. And in closing this chapter, I would like to read a meditation written by Ernest Holmes, which is in our chapter. So if you'd like to just be still and quiet for a moment. God grant that this word shall be first received from heaven, planted in the garden of the soul, watered by quiet contemplation, fertilized by hope and cultivated through faith. It will bring forth a harvest whose planting is deeper than this earth's too thin soil. It will reach up into that purer soil of the Spirit, where the flower withers not and the plant does not die, because it is rooted in the living waters of everlasting life. And as Obi-Wan Kenobi says, remember, the Force will be with you always. And so it is.
So it is.
Thank you.